Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is part two of the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 237 with the legendary Liam Howlett. I hope you all enjoyed part one. I can tell you now, at the end of this podcast, me and Liam talk about the Prodigy's collaboration with an artist called Riker. And I've collaborated with Riker as well, as you hear at the end of the podcast. And me and Riker decided that for Halloween, we made essentially a He-Man toy of me. Previously, on my birthday in August, and they sold out in no time. So we decided for Halloween to make 13 glow-in-the-dark versions. And despite the fact they normally sell for like 80 quid, 100 quid, I mean, these are ultra-limited, so we could charge more. Riker generally charges a lot more. We decided it's funny to charge £66.60 because it's 666 and... there's 13 of them, and it's Halloween, and they glow in the dark and have a little pumpkin. So instead of grabbing a ton more money off you guys, we've gone, as ever, on what entertains us. So yeah, they're available at speechofelementrecords.com. They may have sold out, but that's, again, a reason to be a member of patreon.com/scroobiouspip. It's less than a quid a month, and you get a heads up on these things. You get... first refusal as such. So yeah, head over there, join that, head to speechofelementrecords.com. me and Liam talk about him signing his record label with the guys at Red Essential / Kirkin Vinyl / The Orchid, which is where I started my label and how I run my label with those guys. So head to speechofelementrecords.com for all that. Are we also talking both parts, I think in this part more, about my solo album Distraction Pieces, which pretty much happened because of Liam. So yeah, there's some good stories. I hope you all enjoy it. I'll be back at the end to tell you what is to come, essentially. All right, I'll talk to you in a bit. For now, this is part two of episode 237 with Liam Howlett. Even asked how much time we've got. Are you in any rush, or
let's go through
because I wanted to, obviously we will get to the new record, yeah, and tours on that, but I was like, that's right, as long as I can take my time. But
totally.
So around the time it kind of, you'd burnt yourselves out, was around the time that the Dirt Chambers dropped, and we got to see a little bit of Liam on his own, and that record was huge for me because it had the rap influence, it had everything there. And so how was that to kind of... And Dirt Chambers was the name of the of your studio and all that kind of
thing, right? It was basically like... it was actually a mix I did for radio... I can't remember.
It was for Annie Mac, right?
I think it was for Annie Mac. I'm pretty sure it was for Annie Mac. And it got received really well. And again, Richard was like, yeah, we should put that out. And I'm like, really? I've never really thought of myself as kind of a DJ again. I'd kind of like stopped being a DJ when I'd left this sort of hip hop thing. And what I'd done was, you know, when you're on the road in sort of late '90s, there's no way of writing music because there was no laptops that had the power to, you know, be able to write. To take them and carry on writing. So it was literally like, if you're on the road, you're not in the studio. So I was out of the studio for a good, you know, couple of years, which I found pretty hard. And then when I got home, I didn't necessarily want to go in the studio. It was kind of weird. So it was like, the Dirt Chamber was a good sort of way. I didn't have to think about it too much. I just thought, that'd be great. I'll do that. And just spent like a week doing it proper old school, you know. Two decks, drum machine, and a four track. No computers, you know. And just basically just built the mix up. And I think the original version had Sergeant Pepper in it. So when... we tried to clear like these 50 or 60 tracks. I kind of like the old, do you remember the Double D and Steinsky sort of like mixes from the 80s? They were like real, you know, sort of mixes of James Brown breakbeats and stuff. They were like, you know, a mix of 5 minutes would have like 100 records in
it. Yeah, it had a thickness to it. It was all overlaying and all overlapped.
So it would have like 10 seconds of this record. And so I wanted to do something like that, really. So just a real sort of mashup of like every style I'm into that kind of represents what we're about, you know. And so it was basically a logistical nightmare to clear it. It was, you can imagine, I mean, I didn't do it, the record company did it.
Yeah.
But for them, you know. But
good luck with that.
Yeah, but I was so happy with the mix, because once I knew the Beatles wasn't going to happen, you know, so I chopped that off and did a new intro. But there was a few other problems we ran into, you know. The Pistols were like, nah. And so I was like, get me Lydon's number.
Yeah.
So I rang him.
Amazing.
Left a message, because he was living in America then, I think. I left a message on his answer machine. I didn't know whether he got it or whatever. And then literally a week later, phone rang at 3 a.m. What the fuck's that? Hello, is that Liam? This is John. And it's great, you know. He's just, he's like, you know, why the fuck do you want to use this? You know, why should I let you use it? And I'm like, and I went into like just telling him about the record and like, you know, and I think that he just wanted to make sure it wasn't a record company thing, you know, and it's, it was coming from someone who respected what he did, what he's about and what he does, you know, and just kind of had this similar conversation with Jimmy Corti, but with the KLF song.
Yeah.
And just I found that if I'd spoken to people more, the things would get cleared, you know. So that was actually a good way forward.
It makes a difference, right?
Moving forward when I'd sample other people's records, like, because the sampling culture is a massive, was a massive thing, you know, back in the early rave days, you know. I do it less, much less now, because it's, I don't know, I kind of have a lot to create the things, you know, and kind of make them sound like they, because all the best stuff's been used, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
kind of like, there's only so many acapellas out there from the old school, you know. But I just like I just found that if I physically got on the phone to someone and spoke to them about and tried to tell them what it was about, rather than being approached by a record company going, can we license your track, you know?
Completely.
You know, do you know what I mean? The hands-on touch.
With me and Dan, when we sampled Radiohead on Letter From God to Man, it was, we weren't getting any word back. And then John Kennedy had him in for a session and he played it to him and talked to him about it. And I don't know if that influenced it, but I know that a week later they had a vote and they cleared it.
Great.
And it was that. It was that personal touch of going, look, it's not just some shit. If you see it on paper, it's easy to go, we don't let anyone sample us.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go, look, it's this. It's not just here's a sample and it's ripping off your song or whatever.
You did the great record with it. You turned it into someone else. We have a lot of people that just since the whole internet thing took off, because, you know, there was no internet when they did Fat of the Land. That happened sort of, I can't remember what year it was, but I mean, I didn't get on it until 99.
It was 98 or 99, anyway. Yeah, so it was a good year after Fat of the Land did.
Yeah, but I mean, but then I don't know how many more years until YouTube and stuff, until people could actually post up their mixes of my track. So we got quite a big sort of like, I don't know, we're the type of band that sort of like people remix.
Yeah.
And I like that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's like when we stuck out the single off this album, the Need Someone track, within like 2 weeks there was 20 bootlegs up there.
Yeah.
And I encourage that, man. I think it's good. But I think with sampling, and you've got to, if you're going to use someone else's piece of music, you've got to do something different with it. You've got to be creative with it. Do you know what I mean? Or the end product's got to give you a different feel, like what you did with that track.
Yeah,
you know,
And that, I mean, that's it. It's and Dirt Chambers opened my eyes up to a lot of that, of the mixing of genres, of the crossing over, and it really influenced my solo record, Distraction Pieces. It's one of the albums I sent out to the collaborators on that, and it's a weird one, because originally I was going to be making that album with just me and my mates, and then you and me talked about doing a track together, and it never happened, but that gave me the idea to hit up Danny Lona of Nine Inch Nails, and to hit up a Richard Russell and Steve Mason and people like that, and make this album that was that was this collaborative thing. And it's a weird one, because I was thinking back earlier, I'd genuinely forgotten about it, but the reason that came about was because a little while before that, you'd asked me to try writing some lyrics, potentially for some Prodigy stuff, and I was too green at that point. I wrote Scroobius Pip lyrics. I didn't write Prodigy lyrics, but it just made me think of it then, because one of the tracks I sent over was A History of Hip Hop, and it pointed out,
got it on the computer.
It pointed out the beautiful irony of sampling in hip hop pretty much started with the Ultramags. They were the first to bring in these James Brown drops and things like that.
Yeah.
And then it was the Ultra Mags who were going, yeah, smack my bitch up, yeah, that you've then signed. And it's, yeah, this beautiful cycle, yeah, there. It's a it feels, yeah, like a respectful cycle of,
yeah,
here's how it's, yeah, it's developed.
Totally. It's the use of those old records that really changed the sound of hip-hop, I,
yeah,
believe, you know.
Yeah.
Jungle Brothers, and, you know, Bomb Squad, Public Enemy, they were creating something that was just never done before.
Yeah.
Just chaos of sound. And that really influenced me, yeah.
So how was it to take a bit of a break after all that, to kind of stop? Because, again, it did seem like a never-ending escalation. It got bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, to be honest, it was a real bad time. I mean, the good thing about that time for me personally was I met my wife, you know, and basically, so I spent a lot of time hanging out with her, which was great. But on the band side of things, the whole thing fell apart.
Yeah.
Totally fell apart.
How was it personally between all of you?
Me and Keith weren't communicating. It's hard because when you're brothers, you know, the friendship gets in the way of work.
It's really
hard to be best friends with someone and then have like this work thing, which you've got to kind of put the friendship over there for a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that the burnout and just like, you know, just the frustration of waiting to kind of new music, when's it going to happen? I'm like, well, I just need a break, man. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then just give me a minute.
Keith went off and did a solo thing, and Maxim did a solo thing, and I guess I did with that DJ album, you know.
Yes.
So that gave us a bit of breathing space, but it took a long time to glue it back together. And it's the old thing of like the communication just bred paranoia.
Yeah.
No communication, you know.
Yeah.
And that was really, we were kind of like partying quite a bit, and that bred more paranoia between us, you know. And I think Maxim was a mediator at that point, you know, between me and Keith.
Right, yeah. But that's not an easy situation, particularly as you've started off as mates and then got to live your dreams, and then that's what's destroyed it all, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought we'd break up because we're the only people to decide that.
Yeah.
You know, one of us could, none of us said we were leaving. It was unspoken. We just didn't talk. We literally didn't talk for like a couple of years, you know, a year and a half. And then at the same time, Rich is going, come on, are we going to do another album or what?
Yeah, yeah.
West Fat of the Land Part 2.
It's all going really well. Why have we stopped?
So poor Rich, you know, he was trying his best to kind of get me in the studio. And I was like, ah, fuck that, man. You know, I don't want to go in the studio. And, you know, it had to be when I was ready. Do you know what I mean? And then I started what would be Always Outnumbered.
Mm.
I think Baby's Got, I was trying to remember yesterday, I think Baby's Got a Temper as a single.
Yeah.
Was, might have been in between. I can't quite remember the dates. But that actual single, I don't really like that record.
Right. You
know, I mean, that's the one record I don't really care for too much. I mean, when you like the artwork better than you like the music, it's a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But
it had an aggressive,
it was
return
a sonic
sound.
Yeah, it was,
to
a,
it,
it was
right?
a sonic sort of picture of what the band state of the band were in.
Yeah, yeah,
lethargic,
yeah,
yeah. Slow,
right,
and just not very exciting.
Right,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I kind of thought, but you need those moments to kind of go right. It's, you know, we get through that, and you know, nothing bad happened to us. We just stopped communicating, and I think that. Eventually, like, I decided I'd just get back in the studio and start, I wanted to write again, you know, and I just kind of, I think I wrote Always Outnumbered album.
Yeah.
I wrote that in, I moved out of Essex then, I was now living in London, I wrote that in Stoke Newington, got a studio there, and then that sort of came together. But that album was odd because the guys weren't on it, and it was kind of like, all through that album, there was still no communication.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that must have been...
It was a strange
weird
time.
For everyone.
It was weird,
right,
for everyone.
Because the Prodigy...
Yeah.
Keith and Maxim potentially are seeing that there's a Prodigy album, and it's like, all right.
Yeah, I mean, they could see it was getting built. It hadn't come out yet. But, yeah. I mean, basically what happened was we eventually found a way to kind of get back together and communicate, and then we took the tracks we liked off of that album and turn them into live tracks, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what glued us back together, the live show, you know. And then straight away off the back of that, and I didn't want to do this, like EXO wanted to do this singles album, I was like, nah, man, that's really signifies a bit of either an end or a total
right,
change
yeah,
or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I was at the end of my deal with XL, and I felt like I needed a change. I'm sure they did as well. And basically, like, when you've been working with people for so long, you want to kind of work with people that are excited to work with you again.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah.
It was a good sort of agreed thing that we'd sort of part company, me and XL Recordings. And I think that was a good decision, really, on both our parts. But we did the singles album.
Yeah.
And the good thing that came out of that was it brought us directly back into the live thing again.
Yeah.
And that's kind of from that point onwards was when that was the second phase. There was kind of three different phases of the band. That was the third phase of the band.
Yeah. Did that kind of allow you all to remind yourselves how good you are at what you do? Like, do you know what I mean? If you're standing there and you and Keith have drifted apart or whatever else, and then bang, he's there on stage lighting things up again. Yeah.
We had so much anger with us to just through our own personal shit.
Yeah.
And we kind of took it out on the stage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's kind
yeah.
of like, it really helped, and we sort of it glued our friendships back together. Do you know what I mean? And we knew they were always there. And when we spoke about it, it was very emotional and kind of like, you know, but we it was just literally like brothers. They haven't spoken in years, but they know if someone fucking does something to them, they'll be there.
They
got your back. But it's just the kind of, it's just that non-communication and that breeds that paranoia.
Yeah. But, I remember coming to see you guys in Brighton. I can't remember, it was just after you kind of started to get back into the tour and live. And I'll be honest, I went into that as like, I don't know how this will be, you know. It's been a while, we're all a bit older. I'm not that kid who's getting kicked out of Brixton Academy anymore. But then as soon as the gig started, it was exactly the same. It was that energy and that anger and that power. So is that what kind of reignited the passion to do more records, to do all of it, to keep on the road, to go, wow, look at what we are.
Yeah, exactly.
And we still are.
It kind of, like I was saying earlier, we finally found a good way of technically how to play the music live. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Kind of, and to be able to kind of, flip it up at any moment and keep it really spontaneous instead of being locked into a certain live set or whatever. You know, we could change it at any particular moment.
Yeah.
And there was a few electronic bands around that time that were trying to, like people like Pendulum and stuff, you know, they were taking their shit live, you know.
Yeah.
And but in a way they were trying to be a rock band
in a way.
And this is 100%. No criticism on them, but they were drum and bass trying to play like a rock band. We were trying to play like a rave band. But we were kind of just angry.
So
it was, we were never trying to be a rock band or never trying to be rock
completely, you know? And I think what's great there is what you were saying earlier about finding how it works live, because me and Dan had that as soon as you start to get to 2,000 cap type venues, people are like, oh, you need a band. And our argument was always, we didn't write the record with a band, so we didn't add a band. But I think hearing what you were saying there about adding a drummer, but making sure that bass is coming from you still, that it's being driven by you, that you found a way to go, we can add a band, but not replace us with a band.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, because like I always see, like I don't like it when hip hop bands kind of, or rappers kind of, do that when they get to the stage where they have to have a band. It's like the Beastie Boys. I always respected that about.
Yeah.
DJ, I remember seeing 20,000 crowd, the three of them dudes.
A Mixmaster Mike.
Doesn't even come into my mind, why isn't a fucking drummer there?
Yeah. I remember seeing the Streets at one point when they added a band, and it took everything out of it, because those beats were so electronic. It didn't need that. It needed to be that tinny sound.
Absolutely. Got to keep the beats there. And that's why the way we use the drums live, we do use them in a different way. And it is Leo, our drummer, is a great drummer. He's phenomenal. But it's quite a different gig that for a drummer.
Playing drums in our band,
you know, because it's kind of, you have to play around the beat sometimes, not,
that's, you know, mad, you have to
play through it and play a lot of percussive stuff. And same with the guitar. It's kind of like, it's not there to sound like a guitar. It's there to layer up the synth. Do you know what I mean?
It's kind of like
it's to create this sound, you know, and basically like, when that all comes together and it all works, it's really, really good, you know.
And do you kind of play the master of ceremonies role there when you're putting it all together of figuring out who needs to be doing what? Because again, it's as you said, it's not a typical guitarist gig.
No.
So you almost have to play the guitarist as an instrument and play the drummer as an instrument, as well as you're playing the drum machine and all these other, whatever else you're playing.
We strip it out, you know, so when always when we've done an album, like we're about to do it this week actually, we've written the tunes and then okay, it's kind of in my mind as we're doing it, but then right, how are we going to play this live? Okay, and so we'll just take out that part. That'll be the guitar part. But then if it's just guitar, it needs something else backing it. So it's kind of figuring the best way to play the songs live, really.
Yeah.
And some of them are easy and some of them are more difficult, you know, and some of them you don't want a guitar on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or the drums have to be played in a different way so they don't interfere with the beat, you know.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it's everything's kind of like worked through, really. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So how was it when you'd brought everyone back together? And then Invaders, I Must Die. Did that feel like it was a Prodigy album again, rather than a Liam album? Yeah, that was
the first band album I believe we'd wrote. You know, together. You know, and it's kind of when I say together, the guys, their presence in the studio, which is valuable because, like, you know, when you're a unit and Keith's sitting there saying to me, "Oh yeah, yeah, rewind it back about 30 seconds, take it back there." Yeah, yeah, that bit, man. Yeah, because he's hearing it in a different way that I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Other people, like, you know, they can hear other bits in the music where they might be able to interject something. And so that's, it's always, in the beginning, I was always writing music on my own, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, that album really became sort of like a good zone with the three of us. And that's kind of how we've rolled it since.
How's the shorthand between you guys? Because I'm terrible at expressing, like Dan Lesak would, be pulling his hair out because I'll be like, it's not quite right, and like I wouldn't be able to express what's not working. Have you got a good kind of understanding of expressing that and getting it right, or are you pulling your hair out kind of going?
Because it's like, obviously me and Keith have,
I can't make it rounder. I don't know what rounder means.
No, it's obviously me and Keith and Maxim, we've spoken each other's language for 20 years, so it's kind of, I understand and I know which bits I think Keith will like, and I understand kind of how he reacts, and you know, same with Maxim. You know, it's kind of like once I'm writing a tune, I'm thinking, I think Maxim's going to buzz off this one. This is and so I'll send him the first 30 seconds. I might have just written a little demo bit of it, and he's on it, and then he'll come in. But what we try to do, especially with this latest album, is take the pressure out of this kind of studio being the, you come into this room, you've got to write an idea.
Because
you know what it's like in a studio, you shut the door and it's kind of like dead and just really kind of, it can be a shit atmosphere. So it was fine for that Invaders album because it was kind of like we'd never done it before, you know, being all together in a studio.
Yeah.
But when we hit the next album, more chaos happened, a lot of drinking, and I think I had to change the studio because we just couldn't work in the previous one.
Right.
And the Days of My Enemy was quite a chaotic sort of writing sessions. They were really quite mad. Actually, just going back to Invaders as well, there was literally a whole, I think probably 8 tracks, nearly a whole album's worth of material that I binned because it wasn't right. It didn't feel like it was Prodigy enough in a way. Do you know what I mean? It felt too pushed.
Oh, what's the process there of deciding what works, what's not, and bringing people in for inspiration? We used to gig a lot with the Does It Offend You? Yeah, lads. And I know they kind of chatted to you at points and came in.
I know, good with James. I mean, James is a good friend of mine. And basically, I worked with James on this latest album, actually. But,
is that important to have people to kind of, to bounce off? But then it's down to Liam if it's a Prodigy track. It's one thing to make tracks.
It's funny because I'd written, just skipping back to Invaders again, the actual track Invaders Must Die.
Yeah.
Like I'd written the riffs, the melodies and stuff. And then James, I'd met James and I liked it. I think he's a great producer. He's wicked. And I said, I've got this tune. I've kind of got to this part of it. I don't know what to do with it. I really like the melodies. Great, you know. He goes, "Oh, give it to me." And he basically just, he got his dad's bass guitar out, which is the original bass guitar, which the Stranglers used on Peaches.
Because
his dad produced that album, Stranglers. And so that bass guitar is the one you hear on Invaders.
That's amazing.
He played it on there. He goes, "Oh, you're going to love this bass line." You know, it's basically following the melody. So when he gave it back to me, it kind of shone a light on, oh yeah, that's what it's meant to do.
Yeah.
So it's quite a nice collaboration between me and James.
Yeah. And that's a beautiful thing to have fresh eyes on it, right? Because when you're particularly with electronic a production, you put in so many layers on that you can lose some of the early ones. Yeah. You can forget that riff was what was always there.
Exactly.
He's just highlighting on, you know, that's great, but because you've built something on top that you're like, oh, this melody on top is amazing. It's like, but there's this bit that's that you've forgotten about.
That's what it's like. And the good thing about it now is, like, obviously you can go back and kind of, with the computers, you know, you can kind of, version 130 was good, not version 200. And so that, it took quite a while to write that album.
Yeah.
But I think it was, we did a good job of making a band album there. And again, we'd signed a new record deal with, I'd started this label, Take Me to the Hospital Records. Yeah. And it really was just,
working with Cooking Vinyl.
It wasn't a label where I was going to really sign anyone. It was just an imprint because I felt like, who the fuck are Cooking Vinyl?
I was like,
what bands have they got? And they're like, well, they've got a few old bands you might have heard of. And I'm like, well, with respect to Martin, you know, I'm going to let them put the record out, but it's going to be on my imprints. You know?
Exactly. And what I did with Speech Development. Yeah. I went to Cooking Vinyl. I was like, cool, I love Billy Bragg. I love this. Yeah, exactly. But at this point, I feel my energy is better as... this is my label.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I did it as an imprint. I did it through them exactly the same outlook.
It works, man.
And they're amazing at that because they've got the setup there to facilitate that. Yeah. So you can go, right, here's what I'm doing. It will be an independent record, but it will be plugged in to all the avenues it needs to be plugged into, right?
Totally. What was interesting about going to them was I think it was my lawyer or someone had flagged really early on that Martin was someone who's really on the ball and they were a good independent, and he thought I might get the same feel from them as I did when I signed to XL.
Yeah.
That kind of like able Paul to Sprogan. Move quickly. Paul,
he,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. He hooked me up with it. So again, it would have been around. Yeah. It would have been, yeah.
And basically we just, we went in there and we just said we want it set up like we'd had it before.
Yeah.
And so they just did a great job with that album, I think. And, you know, just, again, like I said, I'm not really a record company kind of guy. Yeah. I just like to stick with the music and just like oversee stuff, but I never go into the label or anything. You know, I just like to keep a distance, you know.
So, I mean, it now feels completely natural, having heard what kind of reignited everything, that you then chose to do a live DVD album, cunning, and make a film, essentially, of what the Prodigy is. And it was perfect because it did show it. That it's like, no, this is current and this is now and this is exciting and energetic. It's not kind of, oh, do you remember that song from this time ago? It's like, no, look, here's what we're doing.
That came out of doing that Milton Keynes gig. I mean, basically that was, I guess, following the tradition of when Oasis did Nebworth, you know, it was kind of, they put their stamp on it. They didn't know. They I would imagine, you know, they were like, Nebworth, fucking hell, you know, we're going to do that. I don't know. Maybe they were just like, yeah, we're doing it, and that's that.
Yeah.
But it was a tall order, I thought, at the time, do you know what I mean? For 250,000 people. They pissed it, didn't they, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, I know, because we played it with them, you know, we supported them. And I was amazed myself. I was thinking, fuck, how the fuck did they do this?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like...
Does that open your eyes, though? Yeah. Does that make you go, well, anything's
possible? Yeah, but also we're not total fans of the biggest is the best. You know, we like playing smaller venues. I mean, but it was kind of like the timing was just right. It was like you are saying you're kind of fucking back, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot, we went to Milton Keynes Bowl, and it's such a great venue that I didn't really understand why people haven't used it more.
Yeah.
So that was a great day, and it was a real landmark gig for us. I mean, just the way my head is, I just was like, yeah, okay, great, just do it. It wasn't until I walked out on that stage that I realised that everyone there was there for us.
I knew it was
that gig, but I wasn't prepared to how emotional I'd feel.
To get that around you.
Yeah, because it's kind of like, holy shit, because it's like a bowl and it goes up. I mean, it was 65,000, but like insane, it was 65,000 people you could see rather than just heads going off into the distance.
Yeah,
it kind of ramped up. And so, but it was the thing that, they were there to see our band, you know, and that kind of really touched me in a way. Do you know what I mean? I thought it was great after all these years, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
It's amazing to have those moments. And again, I think the it's back to that punk rock view that people will get hung up on, no, I'd rather see them in a small venue. It's like, well, Yeah, but we're not going to play to 65,000 people every gig now.
No.
This is a special occasion. This is a one-off thing. It's a one-off. We're going to go back to doing these gigs here and there, but
you
shouldn't be ashamed to have pride in that. You should be able to go, this is a fucking amazing thing that we had all these people here.
Yeah, and the good thing about it was we really did try and put ourselves into that whole show, like as far as like choosing the, you know, getting the, all these different cool little areas going, different stages and kind of like, you know, making the whole thing feel like it is an event. It was an event, and it was, we called it the Warriors Dance Festival, and we ended up doing like one in Tokyo. It was a much smaller one. One in Serbia. And there's another one somewhere. I think we, when we went to Australia, we took over the Future Music Festival. We had a Warriors Dance like area. So it was a festival, win a festival, you know, type of thing. But it was just a good landmark gig, I think, for us. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, we do prefer playing inside.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So how is it now gearing up to release a new record, to tour a lot, I'd imagine. Again, generally when we've talked in the past about podcasts or anything else, it's always, if I know that you're about to go on tour, it's like, if I hear from Liam now, I'll be waking up to a 5 a.m. email from. So, other than that, it's fine. You go and do your thing, cunning. So how is that? How exciting is that? After, again, from what you said, you don't do things by halves. After locking yourself away in the studio for however long to put this together, you're now committing to taking yourself away and being with the rest of the guys, with the crew, with whatever else, you know, on this on this run.
It's always great, but the thing is, we're always on the road, you know, so going through the album, we were still doing gigs, so we've never been a band.
It never seemed to stop on this period.
I think it doesn't really work with the music, because we like to keep... The music gets written off the feel of the shows, you know, of that feeling you get. So what I tried to do with this album is kind of like really connect the dots and not have any gap. So, for example, do the show, I'll stay in the shittest, closest hotel.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And get me there as soon as possible. If it's 5 minutes away. I mean, the last one, my manager really took the piss, because we got in the car and literally drove around the back, and it was... The hotel was in the festival. I was like, you're having a fucking laugh. And literally, it was 7 a.m. before I could even hear any music coming out of my laptop, because it was right next to the stage. Yeah, so that was good. But yeah, that
cut. You need a balance there. There's a point of diminishing returns there if you're too close. It's like, all right.
But it was like, to really commit and get it done, just kind of, you know, again, like I say, when doing a record, you know, anyone who thinks they can go into the same studio, act the same, do the same, and think they're going to come out with something different, it don't work for me. Do you know what I mean? It's like you've got to change aspects of the way you work. And for this record, you know, I just worked everywhere. I didn't stick to a studio. I worked everywhere. I mean, I worked at home, you know, mainly on the road. We recorded lots of vocals on this album on the road, in hotel rooms. And I liked the kind of freeness of it. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, we weren't under pressure with this room, this studio, you know, and it's kind of, I spent a lot of time in here, but it was more getting the sonics right, but rather than the recording, you know. Yeah.
Do you think the confidence to change came from that success early on of changing, from the experience to Jilted? Because again, a lot of bands will go, no, this is our sound though, this is how we sound.
I think,
and you guys have always been comfortable and going, no, our sound is completely different now. Honestly, it'll all work at a gig. Like, trust me, it'll all sit together and it'll work and we'll make it. Just take our word on that.
That's funny, because I do think it does sound the same.
Right,
that's my view on it, because I think that as I roll through and listen to the different albums, you know, the fundamental foundation of what the Prodigy is about hasn't really changed, you know. But I think, I think with this latest album, I definitely... We've carved out a sound, you know, and people know us for this type of music, you know. But I think that I definitely looked back towards the first album a bit with this record, not to make it retro, but just to kind of not be afraid to tap into the rave sound, and bring it to the more ferocious kind of drums and bass, what we're doing now, and kind of like, because I think the rave, when people talk about rave music, they always sort of think about sort of the happier side of it. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, we just want to to present what we originally knew about it, which was the kind of East London pirate radio sound. Do you know what I mean? That kind of raucous, raw. And that was kind of a bit of an inspiration with this, you know.
And rough as well. Again, there's a misremembering at times of how rough a lot of the raves say. Again, I wasn't particularly part of it, but I heard a lot about it. That particularly, again, the perception of Essex these days is your only way is Essex, stuff like that. That's not the Essex that I grew up in. It's Essex is a rough... It's like you can get yourself in some trouble.
I don't know when that happened.
I'd
left Essex by that point. It literally was a different place when all that kicked off.
I mean, the Essex I know, you've got to have a bit about you and keep your eyes open and stuff like that. And that's what is forgotten about the rave scene, that they were illegal raves.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that everyone there is going to be lovely. It wasn't Woodstock. Do you know what I mean? There was a positive vibe, everyone together.
It got worse also, and worse, you know, for sure.
It's risky, yeah.
In the beginning, it was... because I stepped into it about 1989, the end of... sort of, I just caught the summer and then of 89 and then all through 90. But towards the end of 90, it got a bit too
quickly,
heavy.
Right?
It got real heavy, you know. And... yeah, it's like anything, I guess, where money's involved. People want their cut, you know. But
Of course.
That always has a bit of danger about it that kind of was exciting at the same time.
Yeah,
you know?
That's what draws you in initially.
Yeah, I think so, you know. And yeah, you want to be reminded of that danger because it's a good feeling, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we don't want a safety net on us all the time.
I couldn't agree
more. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I couldn't agree more. I was literally saying to my girlfriend the other day that if I ever lived in London, I'd rather live in South London because that's where all my family from than in West London, because I'd rather feel as if someone might stab me than feel as if someone's going to tap me on the shoulder and ask me to leave because I feel out of place there. I feel like I'm in the wrong one. And she couldn't relate to that at all. But I was like, I don't know, I like that. Growing up in Essex and South London, that slight edge... Again, just having to be aware of yourself. I don't think that's always a bad thing because it's not a bad thing. It keeps you...
It grounds you for sure.
So, I mean, I'll start to wrap things up now. Touring, burying yourself in studio, you spoke that in the gap from all of that, you met your missus and you started a family.
Yeah.
How does that all balance? How do you hold that together?
It's chaos, but it's great. That's kind of the way it works, you know.
Yeah.
I'm lucky, you know. My missus is in the business, if you like. Yeah. I hate that word, but yeah, you know, she's in her own band, so we've got a really great understanding of how, you know, we've got good support for each other. Do you know what I mean? All that time that I was talking about when I first met my wife, you know, she was there for me, and she's always been there for me, and I'm there for her. So it's kind of like. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, you feel lucky to be called dad.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, but I tell you what though, people always talk about the mellowing.
Yeah.
I think I went the other way.
Right.
Everything was more important, more intense.
Right, yeah,
it
yeah,
gave
yeah.
It
You've
more
got
of a
something
purpose.
To fight for.
Yeah, man, I didn't feel any mellowing coming on at all. I think I've probably got more intense and just more into what I do. Things become more valuable when you've got a family. Yeah. Every little thing becomes
more driven
valuable.
And more, it'll mean something.
I cared less about materialistic things, you know, growing up in Essex, you know, when you first earn a bit of cash, I want to buy that car. I want to buy that Rolex or whatever, you know. But I mean, I don't know, it strips you down to kind of like just the good shit,
I always remember I was at a festival with Billy Bragg, who again, idol of mine because of Essex, because of hearing someone singing in my own accent and stuff like that. And I was there, and his kid was there, and his kid was just embarrassed of his dad, embarrassing dad. And it made me realise how important that is, because once you've had a kid, I guess, I've not got any myself, but you can't worry about being cool.
No.
Because you're going to be an embarrassing dad at some point. They're going to think you're a Wally, they're going to think this or that at some point.
Yeah.
So it does make you...
He's got a long way to go yet, though.
Yeah. It does make you drop some of them silly things that you hold on to try and be cool, to try and be this, to worry about other people's perceptions. You can just be you and go into it, right?
Well. You know, do you know what I mean? You got to set an example, I think, you know?
Yeah.
But,
right.
Yeah, it is great. I mean, basically, like, I just love, like, sitting there and I'll hear, like, the other day I heard like a Madness record that I knew was either a B-side or like a, off the first album, and Ace was playing, and I was like, oi, yeah. What, do you like that? And he's like, yeah, it's great, Dad. I'm like, how do you know about it? You know, yeah. Like, shouting in his bedroom. And it's like, yeah, I just find it really interesting how you know, how he accesses his music. I mean, obviously it's been happening for a few years now, but I think that, like, I think music, like, that's why the live side of things is really important, because it's the direct, pure route to the people standing on stage playing to people. It's such a big part of the band. Whereas what reminded me of, like, what my son was doing was accessing music through games or it being the soundtrack of a film or something, you know, but not a first thing, you know, of listening to the radio like we used to do.
Yeah, completely.
Of course, you know, we don't want to live in a dinosaur age, but I just think that if someone had a button, they turned music off, maybe it might remind people how important it is.
Yeah,
like if it suddenly went from the soundtracks and it suddenly went from backing up games, you know, people might respect it a bit more.
It's become such a disposable thing.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you're saying there about the generational thing. And we mentioned right at the start, gigging with Green Day or being at a festival with Green Day. And Green Day are one that stand out to me as when I was at school, they were one of the most important bands for me. There's kids at school now who they're one of the most important bands for. And whilst I might not be into their current stuff or whatever else, it's that amazing thing to be able to continue to be that band that means the world to these young kids when they're finding music or when they're finding what they're into.
Yeah.
And the Prodigy are an example of that as well. That,
yeah, thanks, man.
You know, when I came to see you guys last, it wasn't all us older boys. It was a range. It was a variation. It was people of all ages there.
Yeah, we do. I think that we first noticed that when we released the singles album and then going into Invaders, we suddenly were like, shit, it's a young audience into us.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of that is to do with the type of music is as well. I think this music can't die. You know, it just finds a way of evolving into something else. You know,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It just, every now and then it will get a bit rinsed out and then another sound will happen. You know, it's kind of, it all kind of links back to us in some weird way.
Yeah.
You know, in the way of, like, historically.
Yeah.
So I think kids kind of see that, you know, in a way.
Yeah.
You know.
I get that. I mean? Well, I'll round things up by talking about, I can see a Biggie bust there, which is from the man Riker.
It is from the man Riker, yeah.
I've done two toy collaborations with him now. I love him. And I was so excited when he was doing one with you boys.
Yeah.
And how was that? So for people who don't know, Riker is an artist who makes these amazing kind of art toys and all sorts of things like that. And he came and did a Prodigy one.
Well, I saw yours and I was jealous and I thought, man, that's fucking cool, that is. No, he's a great guy, Riker. I mean, I bought quite a number of his pieces off of him.
Yeah, he's an amazing artist.
What else have we got in here? I've got the thing, Slave to the Rhythm somewhere.
Yeah.
And a few other pieces at home. And so I was aware of him for a while, you know, and then when I saw the stuff you did.
Yeah.
And, yeah, we just kind of, it's like any little bits of kind of merchandise. You kind of, it amuses you that you could kind of do these things.
Yeah.
You know, why would I want a figure of myself? Do you know what I mean? But it was a laugh doing it. Do you know what I mean? It was kind of like, you know.
That's exactly it.
It was just fun, you know, kind of limited edition thing. But Riker, I've got a lot of respect for him. You know, he's great. He's a great guy, you know.
Oh, we're doing, it's weird because I was talking to him yesterday and we did this He-Man's size run. We had Masters of the Spoken Verse.
Yeah.
And he just hit me up saying, did I ever tell you I made some glow-in-the-dark ones? No, you didn't really tell me that. And he was like, do you want to release them? I was like, well, I'm seeing Liam tomorrow and the Liam podcast is coming out on Halloween. Let's release a few limited glow-in-the-dark ones. I'll make sure we send one out to you.
Yeah.
Let's release a few limited glow-in-the-dark ones.
He did one of me glow-in-the-dark.
It's amazing.
I've got it at home in the cupboard. And
I love it when he does that. Like, you agree a collaboration. And then I go, also, again, he's like on this He-Man one. He was like, I made a one for each of us that's covered in blood. I'm like, wicked. It's not available for anyone else to buy. But it's like, all right, mate, cool.
I mean, look around me in here, man. I mean, I'm still a kid, aren't I? Look.
I love it. As soon as I walked in, it's all this stuff that I've looked at online myself or I own myself. I love it. There's good collections.
I went through a stage when I this is when I liked the internet, when I realised I could buy all the old toys I had when I was a kid. I was are you kidding me? I could sit here for a week just on my computer buying all my old toys.
Mate, I've paid too much of that.
Pay through the roof for them. Yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah, you know.
Well, I'll wrap things up, but speaking of the internet, you normally end by saying, where can people follow you? Before I ask that, what do you think of it all, of social media, of the way it's all gone? Because your Instagram, the Prodigy Instagram, it's done really well. It's not over. It does what it does. It's not feeling like it's just here for marketing, but equally it's not kind of here's our breakfast.
I'm not a tweeter.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because I think when you take pictures of stuff, it is the band's Instagram.
Yeah.
But I mean, I do mainly I mainly take the pictures on it, but I kind of like that. You know, it's kind of a bit of weirdness thrown in as well.
Yeah.
And we don't want it to be sort of industry or business related too much. Do you know what I mean? Completely. It's an insight of what the three of us are into. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't like social media personally, because it's, for me, I'm too busy for it. Do you know what I mean? I'd rather be looking at a drum machine than looking at my phone to see how many messages I've got. I just use the phone so I could speak to my family and my friends, and that's it. I don't have a Facebook. I don't do anything.
I just
use the Instagram to take pictures of the band and to inform people of like what we're into and what movements we're making. I don't know if that's me saying I'm rebelling against it. I just haven't got the time for it.
Yeah,
I'd rather be outside walking about or looking at something in real life, you know.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? That's perfect. Yeah. So
I'm into movies. I mean, I don't really watch TV a great deal.
What kind of movies are you into?
Everything, but I particularly like I love horror genre, you know, and old school horror.
Have you seen a film called Calibre?
I haven't, no.
It's on Netflix. I had the director on yesterday. So it'll be coming out after this, but it's amazing. It's more a thriller, but his shorts were all horrors.
Right.
And it's on Netflix, and it's just about two guys essentially in a small village in Scotland.
Yeah.
It gets Stephen King tweeted about it and compared it to Wicker Man.
Right.
So again, you suffer a bit from that, because it's like, well, it's not Wicker Man. It's like, no, of course it's not Wicker Man. It's its own thing. But it's kind of exciting how there's so much freedom. I have love hate with all the digital thing, because I love the cinema.
Yeah.
But I'm also aware that...
Do you still go?
Yeah, all the time. Constantly. I love it. I love empty cinemas, go on my own.
Nat doesn't like going. I like going to the cinema.
Yeah.
It's something, I don't know, analogue about it.
Yeah, school, yeah, you know? It's real. It's just, you can't be distracted by the cup on the side in your living room or whatever else. You know what I mean? You are just... It's darkness. Bits. Exactly. Yeah. It's darkness. Yeah. You're fully immersed in it. But equally, because of the way cinema has gone, I'm aware that there's a lot of really good films that wouldn't get made if it wasn't for Netflix, for Amazon, for these streaming services. So it's a weird balance there, because I'm appreciative of it, but still, if something comes out only on Netflix, I'm like, just put it on in one cinema just so I can go and watch it there. I'd rather go and sit there and watch it.
Yeah, totally. Especially coming out of a studio all the time, you know, sort of that sort of intense work schedule.
Yeah.
There's certain programs that I just have as like a bit of a security blanket.
Yeah.
You know, things like Curb Your Enthusiasm.
That is
Larry is my hero.
Yeah. He's gold.
I've got to send him props, you know.
Yeah.
So that will be like a good thing to have on my computer if I'm in dark Russia. I've got fucking 2 weeks of staying here. At least I've got Larry.
I can't wait for one of your gigs. where you forgot to close it all down properly, and as it boots up, you just get ding, 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 just to a stadium of Prodigy fans. Oh, sorry, hang on. Here's where we're going.
Yeah.
So is that a key then? Having those things that allow you to switch off because of how intensely you live your work life, your touring life.
Yeah, I don't ever switch off. That's the thing. I've realised that it's always on somewhere. It's really difficult. I mean, I do when I go on holiday, I don't take anything with me, you know.
Yeah.
So that's wise, I think.
Yeah.
And that's really the only time. I mean, it's really important to be able to do it. But once you're in it, you're in it, and you can't switch off, you know.
Yeah, really, yeah.
I think you think you can, but it's always lurking in the background. Someone's always got a question. Oh, did you approve the sleeve for this, or did you? You
know,
but it's fine, man. You know, it's the way it's always been, and it's fine. I haven't got a problem with it, you know.
Yeah. It's a fascinating one. When you are your job, there's no. I figured it out a few years back. The reason I don't, again, it's different if you've got a family. But the reason I don't enjoy holidays that much is you need a boss to be on holiday from. I can't get away from me. I'm always there. So it's that kind of, I go on holiday and I'm still thinking about work and I'm still doing some writing or whatever else. So
you're right.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for all the time you've given. You've gone above and beyond here. And No Tourist is out on November 2nd.
Yeah.
And then what's the kind of the touring schedule? Constant, right?
Yeah. Well, basically, like, we always know what we're going to do 6 months in advance, you know. And next year there's also going to be something else we're going to be putting out.
Wicked.
That's all I can say about
that. All right, that's good. That's all I need to know.
So, yeah, man, I'm going to play you a couple of tracks in a minute, actually.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, I'll stop there and we'll get on with that. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Scroobish Pips Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was part two. I hope you enjoyed both parts. As I mentioned in part one, if you're new to this podcast, again, a lot of new people on Spotify, Acast, iTunes, all these places. If you're new to it, then have a browse through the back catalogue. We've got all sorts of people from Zane Lowe to DJ Yoda to Simon Pegg. I'm scrolling through there in front of me. Stephen Graham, Kathy Burke, Limmy was great. Edith Bowman was an amazing episode. Michaela Cole, who's coming back soon. Lauren Laverne. I mentioned Goldie, right, because that was a relevant one. Huey Morgan, another great one. Aisling B, who was recently fantastic on the Films to be Buried with podcast. Absolutely hilarious. Johnny Lee Miller. You know, a fellow short-haired, bleach blonde, along with Liam. Just tons of good people. Also, I had Nick Hawkes on, who is Liam's manager, who sorted all this out, and who originally signed the Prodigy. So that could be a good one to go and listen to if you're a Prodigy fan. Anyway, I'll wrap things up. I told you I'll let you know some of the upcoming guests, because I feel I've been holding off. Next week is the return of Michaela Cole. I'm very excited about that. The week after that, I've got Michael Venom Page, MVP, on the podcast. So that's a great one. Then, I've been holding off on announcing this because it's another legend, but I'll let you know. Then we've got John Cooper Clark. So just, we're ending this year as strongly as we've maintained that strength all year, to be completely honest. So thank you for tuning in. I'll see you all next week as Michaela Cole returns for a fantastic chat about all the stuff that she's done since I last had her on, man. She's been in a full episode of Black Mirror. She's been in Star Wars. She's been in Black Earth Rising, which has blown me away. Been So Long is a fantastic new film of hers on Netflix. We'll talk about all this next week. Chill out, guys. I'll see you in a bit. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.